Today we're going to talk about the SQL Server for the Oracle DBA course, and it's going to be adapted from the Scalability Experts slides, and the content is can be found in the below link. So I just want to give attribution to the folks that created this content. Thanks. Hey everybody, Mike Wilmot here with Christine Kors. We're both SQL Server Technical Specialists at Microsoft. The advantage that we have today is that Christine has plenty of years at Oracle and is going to give us some insights about Oracle as it relates to the topic at hand, which is SQL Server for the Oracle DBA. Now, Christine, do you want to say anything about yourself?
Sure. So I actually work for Microsoft now for the past year, and I 8 years working at Oracle, and many years before that working with Oracle.
And what we're going to do is talk about architecture today. So Christine's going to take this architecture slide, and then we're going to kind of flip back and forth.
So the first thing we really wanted to go over with you is some concepts that we have of a database and an instance. So basically, a database management system has two pieces to it, an instance, which is the processors that run it, and the database, which are the set of physical files where we actually store the data. Basically, all the hardware resources of the system, anything from a memory or CPU side, that's really what facilitates the usage of the database for the client.
Great. Thanks, Christine. You can also see that on each slide we've got, if it's just Oracle, then it just says Oracle. If it's a SQL Server, it's a SQL Server, but this is both. So the concepts when both things are true are kind of marked with a SQL Server and Oracle delineation there. And so this right here talks to one of the major differences between Oracle and SQL Server is that I'll start with SQL Server since that's what I'm most familiar with, but in SQL Server you can have multiple instances and multiple databases. And this allows you to have, say, up to 50 instances on a single machine. And Microsoft really likes to abstract a given database out, so it kind of separates user functionality, business functionality through the concept of a database. So this is largely different than, and also again, it also has things like schemas within those databases. The Oracle notion is quite a bit different. In the Oracle world, when you have a given instance, you just have a single database. That database may have n number of schemas in it, but it's one of the major differences between Oracle and SQL Server is that SQL Server really likes to chunk it down into the database level, and Oracle, it's a much broader look at your data. It's much more expansive, I guess. Neither one is right or wrong. It's just a difference in kind of the way that you architect what a database looks like. Christine, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, yeah, and I think that's just a big concept difference for people to understand. In Oracle side, an instance always maps to a single database, so a little bit different thought process for SQL.
Great. Okay.
So the next thing I want to talk about is the database capacities. Not a real big difference one way or another, but you'll see we broke down some of the different capacities, and we used Windows as a guideline. It's the only operating system that SQL Server can work on. But things like block size, the maximum and minimum for block size, what you could potentially have in terms of a file size and the minimum number of files. The big difference you'll see here is that Oracle actually allows you to change the data block size. And the reason for that is because Oracle can run on different operating systems. So why Oracle allows that is you can really, when you set up your Oracle database, really set the block size to match what works for that particular operating system or hardware platform. But going on, you'll really see that things kind of match up, just differences between instances per server, not really a big difference there. I didn't run into too many Oracle environments with 50 instances on them. And then file size, maximum log file size, all those things are just limitations within the software. There's no real limitations of your actual database size.
Great. Yeah, it's a great point that Oracle is more configurable around block size, whereas SQL Server, everything is kind of at the page level, and a page in SQL Server is always 8 kilobytes. Okay, great, Christine. Thanks a lot for that. We're going to go to the next slide now. So this right here talks to the schema and data structure difference between SQL Server and Oracle. In SQL Server, we introduced the concept of a schema in SQL Server 2005 that really allows for the logical separation of objects and is competitive to the Oracle notion of a schema. And what that allowed is that if a person leaves an organization, they don't necessarily have to have the ownership of their username tied to those objects anymore. So that was the nice part from a security standpoint of adding schemas, that we once we schematize the database, users can come and go in a much more regular fashion without disrupting the business flow. So that's where you'll see in SQL Server versus Oracle kind of a difference between the two is this notion of a sequence in Oracle versus an identity column. So what you have in SQL Server is, say, an integer. You might have an identity that increments itself 1 through n for if you have n records. And that notion is similar in Oracle. The advantage on the Oracle side is that an identity is called a sequence, and a sequence in Oracle can actually span multiple tables. So, Christine, do you have any kind of thoughts on how that works?
No, I think you summed it up, the fact that you can use a sequence number across multiple tables.
Yeah, so that's a nice feature. When companies are converting from Oracle to SQL Server, that's always a main sticking point. That and the whole schema notion, just getting that through people's thinking are two of the main blockers there.
So from a storage architecture, we went through and just put a picture together because that usually helps people see what the differences might be. Basically, from an architecture perspective, we talk about both physical and logical structures. From a physical perspective, for both database technologies, it's things like data files, log files, and then down to the operating system blocks. The logical structures is how we subdivide that and those file types to manage storage space. The big difference you'll see when you look at these two pictures here from an Oracle and SQL Server perspective, one is the temporary table spaces. From an Oracle side, Oracle DBAs are used to temporary table spaces. Those are used for any kind of special operations, things like sorting data if it's too large for memory. And those get created when the database is created. The only other difference really is that temporary table spaces use something called temporary files or temp files rather than regular data files. And the only difference there is you might not immediately see them grow to the size that's been allocated, and that also depends on platform. So Oracle DBAs are used to this. If the size looks small, don't panic. It'll eventually grow to what you expected. From a SQL Server side, we have something called a TempDB, and I think we'll get into this a little bit more later, but it's basically a global resource that any users connected to the instance can use to follow things, to store things like temporary objects. So global or local temp tables, temporary stored procedures, cursors or table values. So a little bit of a difference there in the use of the word temp. And then the other thing is just a terminology difference, table space versus file group in SQL Server. So those are synonymous. And then also segments versus heap or index. So those are the differences I wanted to point out.
Yeah, that's a great point. And from a SQL Server standpoint, you can put file groups on, if you have different hard drives, you could put file group on drive D, drive E, and drive F if you wanted. You can also back up those file groups separately. And from another architecture standpoint, if you look at the Oracle, the block size, like we talked about in a previous slide, the block size can vary, whereas SQL Server always looks to have an 8K page. So that's just a little bit of a difference there. So this talks to the different types of files supported by SQL Server. You always have a primary data file, so you always have an MDF file. That's your main database file. And with each database, you also have a log file. That's going to be your LDF. And alternatively, if you want to span your database across multiple file groups for both performance and things like backup, then you're welcome to create any number of these NDF files, which are file groups that are in addition to your primary file group.
So in terms of mapping table spaces and file groups, just going a little deeper into that, you'll see in this picture we really show a lot of the terminology differences. So things like a system table space in Oracle would be equivalent to, in SQL Server, a master database. The same thing with auxiliary tables, mapping to resource database. So this might be something that's handy as you're learning SQL Server to be able to help you with some of the terminology differences as you go down the line.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, and it's just nice to know if you have a big file table space in Oracle and you're not sure how that maps to SQL, then something like this will give you some insights into do things like that even exist, or, you know, hey, in Oracle, I'm used to the fact that we had, you know, 3 or 2 redo logs. Why do we only have 1 in SQL Server? So this is kind of a way, a quick visual way of trying to differentiate the two and figure out where things are co-joined, where they're separated, things like that. So this is a great visual for that. Now this is about the logging model, and it applies both to Oracle and SQL Server. I'll probably let Christine talk to the first bullet point in terms of how Oracle does redo logs, and then I'll talk to the SQL Server side.
Sure. So the Oracle DBAs that are sitting in on this session, Oracle redo logs are really recording the before image, really what the data looked like before you actually make a change, so before the application or an end user makes the change to the data.
Okay, great. So just to the point of this slide, SQL Server implements both the redo logs that Oracle has as well as the undo statements or segments in this concept of a rolling log file. So you have a single log file that you have these log sequence numbers, and you can essentially, that's why SQL Server is a transactional database, because you can always go back to the log file to find out inserts, updates, deletes that were done, and roll back if need be.
So again, a similar slide, just breaking up some differences in the data dictionary. In Oracle, the data dictionary, we store that underneath the SIS schema, SYS, in the system table space. So a little bit different. I'll let Mike talk about SQL Server.
Yeah, in SQL Server, what's really helpful in SQL Server is to use things like you know, system tables, dynamic management views are very helpful in terms of really trying to find a specific piece of information about your system. You might want to look at things like index usage, table usage, memory management, who's logged in on the system. You can use these DMVs for doing reporting. So if you have a reporting services report that you want to surface some information about your SQL Server, you can actually create an RDL file, and which is a reporting services file that you can actually surface up information about these RDLs. And also an object that's really helpful is using this information schema view. And if you do a Bing search on information_schema, it'll show you all sorts of information that you can look at, all the objects in your SQL Server database. You might want to look at what are all my tables look like, what do my indexes look like. You can alphabetize them by leveraging T-SQL, and you can say select. You can do a select on, say, tables from information schema, where the table name is equal to foo or something like that, and it'll give you a list of all those tables that are in the information schema. So the information schema is really nice to look at things like user-defined functions, views, tables, any kind of objects in your database that you want to do some kind of reporting, or you want to maybe dynamically create some T-SQL on the fly that relates to multiple tables. That's how I've used the information schema in the past. Also, SQL Server has a resource database that was mentioned earlier that has metadata for system and stored procs. So yeah, this talks to the Oracle sequence versus SQL Server identity, and again, this is one of the main gotchas between the two. When you've got an Oracle sequence that spans tables, whereas a SQL Server identity is more just on a specific table. So this is something to be aware of. When you declare it, you declare it as an identity here, and it can be something like a primary key that you want to have. Say your orders, you want to have your orders numbered chronologically, It's a nice way to do that. Also, we have these globally unique identifiers, so things like replication uses a GUID. You also might want to generate them for, say you have a .NET application that you want to generate GUIDs and use those GUIDs for, say, orders or specific customers. So anything that you need a globally unique identifier that should be global across the planet, then you can generate a GUID. Also, if you want to use something like a synonym, you can create a synonym for a table or some kind of object in your database. So in this case, the schema.theproduct becomes my product in the synonym. So it's maybe a more plain text way of talking about a specific object in your database. So the next topic we'll talk about is database access. And I will go ahead and let Christine talk to this one.
So structured query language, or SQL, basically both Oracle and SQL use SQL 92 standard compliant SQL. Both support most of the core features of some other releases, SQL 99 and SQL 2003. And we have a few different categories of SQL statements within the standards, and we'll talk a little bit about some of those. Things like DDLs and DMLs that DBAs are familiar with, as well as transaction control statements, session control statements, and system control statements, things that need to be done from a DBA or a database perspective.
And that's a good point, Christine. You know, a lot of our customers ask, hey, if I want to make a conversion from Oracle to SQL, how hard is that going to be? And so some of the differentiators is if you're using, say, custom functions in or anything custom to Oracle or SQL, it's going to make it difficult to make that switch from one database vendor to another. So things may be ANSI 92 compliant, and that's great, but there's always going to be something that's platform specific to Oracle or SQL Server that's going to be something you have to look at. So if you run something like a software that analyzes your Oracle database to see if it's compliant with SQL Server, you're going to run into specific issues around these types of statements that are specific to Oracle. So this slide talks to the control statements for both Oracle and SQL Server, and you can see that there's quite a bit of similarity in terms of what does it take for me to commit a transaction or to roll back a transaction. Some of the verbiage is a little bit different between Oracle and SQL Server, but generally you've got the same functionality between the two, where you can run a transaction and then you can commit that transaction and or roll it back at the end. Also, there's a little bit of a gotcha. If you're a SQL Server person and you try to do some work in Oracle, you're going to find that if you do, say, a select statement in Oracle, at the end of that you're going to have to run a commit statement at the end just to make actually more of an update. So you're doing an update, you have to specifically run a commit statement at the end of that, whereas SQL Server, if you run an update statement in the T-SQL editor, you're going to it'll update automatically. So things like inserts, updates, deletes, and Oracle must be committed prior to them actually being committed, whereas SQL Server just actually commits them instantly. So, Christine, any thoughts on that?
Nope, I think, and that's a big difference for Oracle DBAs, is knowing about the automatic commit in SQL Server.
Right. So, and just one caveat to all this stuff too is I'll mention the SQL Server Migration Assistant, and there's a Migration Assistant for Oracle and for multiple database vendors, just to be aware of that. That SQL Server Migration Assistant will look at, say, an Oracle database, and will go through and look at all these types of differences between the two database platforms and give you a sense of what's going to be easy to convert, what's going to be hard to convert, if it can create any shims for you that help with the conversion process, and what you're going to have to kind of do manually on your own. And the process has gotten to the point where, you know, on a good day, 80 or 90% of the Oracle database will convert over to SQL Server, and there'll be a 10% mop-up effort that will be required. So something to be aware of there.
So for tools for development, there's a couple of different tools that we have for creating queries. For a command line perspective, which is what most Oracle DBAs are used to using, SQL Plus for Oracle, There's also SQL CMD for SQL Server, so very similar interfaces there. And then for a GUI interface, some DBAs are used to using SQL Plus for Oracle. On the SQL Server on the Microsoft side, there's SQL Management Studio. And then beyond integrated tools, there's Visual Studio, .NET for Microsoft if you want to go that route. A lot of companies use things like ToadSoft, and that can be used both for SQL Server or for Oracle, depending on what you're used to.
Great. Yeah, that's one of the things we pride ourselves on at Microsoft is having a really easy, rich user interface, graphical user interface. So like Christine mentioned, you can use something like Visual Studio and VS 2010. There's the fidelity between VS 2010 and the SQL Server Management Studio is a fantastic fidelity. So you can either do queries from within Visual Studio. So you get a great fidelity between .NET and or if you want to use Management Studio and SQL Server. As a developer, you can just leverage .NET, or if you're more of a DBA, you can go right into Management Studio and see all the objects there as well. So as far as error handling goes, a nice addition to SQL Server is the ability to do try-catch statements. And so this has always been a first-class offering as far as development goes, is to be able to try-catch exceptions, where you try to do something, if it throws an exception, you can catch that exception. So this kind of a dev notion is baked into SQL Server now, where error handling is not it's not opaque, and it's very upfront. If you throw an exception, you can catch that, and you can look at the different errors that you get. Whether it's an informational message, it might be a low severity level, something that needs to be corrected by the user is in the 11 to 16 range, something that can't be corrected by the user is a 17 to 19, and then if you've got a really kind of a bad thing happening, then you get 20, 25. So you can take these errors, you can send them to an event log, you can send them to, say, a pager or a cell phone, something like that, and I'll go ahead and let Christine talk to kind of the way that Oracle does things.
So from the Oracle perspective, it's more on the predefined exception, so things that'll come back from a query or an application, things like no data found, too many rows found, and those sort of errors that, similar to the severity level that Mike pointed out with SQL Server, you're used to getting those errors back from Oracle.
Right, and both platforms allow you to create custom exceptions, which is nice. If you have something specifically that you want to catch, you know, you can do that. Also, on both platforms, there is the way to look at cost-based optimization, execution plans. So if you have a query that you're running and you're finding that it's a fairly complex query, say it's, you know, 30, 40, 50 lines deep and plenty of joins, plenty of usage of indexes, and it leverages the primary foreign key relationships between tables, then you're gonna run into optimization challenges, and that's where having these kind of graphical view of things like nested loops or joins or cluster index scans and seeks, you can really dive into where am I spending most of my time and can I optimize that either based on my knowledge of the system or asking SQL Server to say run some workloads and then do some analysis on its own around things like the choice of columns for indexes and things like that. So Christine, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, very similar type of thing. The key to good optimization and for cost-based optimizers, make sure your statistics are up to date in either platform.
So we talked about this a little bit earlier, but it's the whole idea of a commit or rollback, and we talked about explicitly committing things in SQL Server, whether it's a begin tran and a commit tran, or if you're setting implicit transactions on or off. You can also do things like distributed transactions, so if you've got multiple systems that you need to keep in sync, then you can actually distribute a transaction across across multiple systems. And a two-phase commit is a nice way in both platforms of making sure that if two things need to happen or neither needs to happen, then the TPC or the two-phase commit is a nice way to do that.
So there's a little bit difference in the way locking works in both database systems. Oracle, by default, it's row-level locking, but you can also lock an entire table. SQL supports lock escalation, so a little different starting at the row by default, but then rather than jumping right to the table, you can do locking by the page or partition. And either database system, you can do explicit locking just using lock hints in both databases.
Yeah, that's a great point. And so in 2005, too, we introduced the ability to manage locks that is more consistent with the way that Oracle does things. And that's really a notion in SQL Server called snapshot isolation. If you do a Bing search of snapshot isolation, then you'll be able to kind of see how we were able to be consistent with how Oracle treats things. And if you want to treat a bunch of transactions as a group, then you can say, I want my database to be completely consistent from the beginning of a transaction to the end of a transaction. And it'll leverage tempDB to make sure that you have a transactionally consistent database throughout. So that's called snapshot isolation. So the next slide we're going to talk to is database security. And in SQL 2005 and beyond, we were able to make quite a few improvements in database security around things like schemas and a much more granular kind of permission set in SQL Server. You can also do things like have actions audited, so you can have both your DDL and DML to be auditable. So if you're doing things like creating a table or even things like select statements or updates can be auditable, which is really nice. So your data definition or data manipulation language both can be auditable. You can have a report that prints out every time a certain individual looks at, say, the payroll table. That can get logged to an audit. And for SOX compliancy reasons, you'd want to do this type of thing as well. You can also have the SQL Server shut down if for some reason, the audit log fills up on your hard drive. It will shut down the SQL Server, so you can make sure that your SQL Server is rock solid in terms of from an auditing standpoint. You can also use things like SQL Server Profiler to see what's going on in the system, to have it show every possible T-SQL statement that's happening on the system. And you can also do things like data definition language triggers and event notifications for auditing. So you can set a specific event to trigger on your SQL Server that will fire in for a specific event that you want to watch. Christine, any thoughts on this?
No, I think that's the big thing, to just point out that you can really do auditing on both sides for depending on what your requirements are.
Okay, great.
We just sort of broke up the security agenda. We're going to talk a little bit about the different pieces of security: users, privileges, roles, and then overall database security. So I can talk to user management. In Oracle, a username is used throughout the database system. SQL Server uses login accounts to access the instance and user accounts for the databases. Both systems let you do operating system authenticated or database authenticated, so that's the same. The biggest difference here is that SQL Server can actually do authentication on the network domain. So, again, because of our closeness with the Windows operating system, we can do that on the network side.
Good.
So, and the last thing for SQL Server, when you're creating a user account, you need to create that in every single database that needs access. You can actually name it different than the login name if you want, so that's a little bit of a difference for the Oracle DBA.
Great, yeah. In SQL Server, you can have a login that is more server-focused or database-focused. So let's talk a little bit about privilege management. In the SQL Server world, you can do things like run alter database statements. You can grant privileges to the grant statement. Some of the permissions you might have on a given database are things like select, insert, update, delete. So any kind of T-SQL notion there, you can have really fine-grained permissions there to give permissions. So you can grant permissions, revoke permissions. You can deny, also use deny to suspend privileges if you want. Any thoughts on this, Christine?
No, again, I think it's very similar, a lot of the SQL ANSI standard commands.
Okay.
So from a role management perspective, both Oracle and SQL have predefined system roles and also user-defined roles. In SQL Server, there's two different categories: fixed server roles, which are just for the individual server, and then fixed database roles, which their scope is limited to the database. From a terminology perspective, the fixed server role of sysadmin is the same as the Oracle sysdba, so that's something to remember when you're first setting up a database. That's probably the first difference you're gonna run into. And then in Oracle, they have a single DBA role that has instance-wide privileges, so that's sysdba. In SQL Server, the administrative privileges can be limited either to individual databases if you want, and you can do that using the fixed database roles.
So in SQL Server, in actually both databases, security is implemented through the database management systems using logins and privileges. So you might be someone that's a schema owner. If you're a schema owner, you have cognizance over the entire schema. You might just be an application user. So if you want an application just to leverage SQL Server via specific application user logon, and that's the only context they have, then that's something you can do from the development side. Also, if you just want someone to be specifically just an administrative user, then you would set them as an administrative user where they can do administrative tasks on the SQL Server. They're not necessarily there to be doing the dev tasks, so it's a separation of duties there. You can also do things like have authentication maybe done just via database logon. You might also have a Windows logon. Say you have a domain user that you want to give access to the SQL Server. That's really the preferred method on the Microsoft side is using Windows Security. And you can also have it match whatever your permissions are in your Active Directory as far as things like password expiration or things like complexity of the password. Thoughts on that, Christine?
No, again, very similar. Both database management systems have security options.
Okay. So this is a SQL Server only slide, so I'll go ahead and take that. So in SQL Server 2005, we began to offer encryption, and encryption in SQL Server 2005 was mainly for things like passwords. So you can encrypt a password column in your SQL Server database. The nice thing about SQL Server 2008 was you're able to encrypt an entire database in SQL Server 2008, and you don't have to make any changes to your third-party applications. So in 2005, if you encrypt a column, then you're going to have to be doing things like decryption and encryption of that data. Whereas when you introduce a database level encryption, then you're not paying hardly any performance penalty at all in doing that. So once you get into that container, you can do things like do indexes, updates, selects, all with no performance penalty. And you can also leverage database encryption keys that are maybe stored in a hardware security module made by a third party, so you can do third-party management of your encryption keys. So that was a nice advancement in 2008. Christine, any thoughts on this?
Again, pretty similar to what the Oracle offering is. The one thing that we don't talk about here is licensing, but transparent data encryption is part of the advanced security option for Oracle, where it's included in the Enterprise Edition of SQL.
That's a great point. A lot of our competitive vendors charge for all the different features that like Christine is saying, are out of the box if you get the Enterprise version of SQL Server.
So we'll talk a little bit about data access and data connection methods. Oracle SQL, I'll do that first since we're talking to the Oracle DBAs in this audience. SQL, the SQLNet, basically TNS names, the file that you're used to editing, and DB links is how you access other databases from an application. A little bit different terminology and technology. SQL Server, we use the concept of link servers and using OLEDB providers. And Mike, you're quite a bit of a developer. I don't know what you have to add for that.
Yeah, I would say this is another one of the confusing parts for folks that come directly out of the Microsoft universe that are trying to understand Oracle, and that is this whole idea of a TNSNames.ORA file, where you have to do some configuration there, which really, from a SQL Server standpoint, that just doesn't have to happen. So that configuration is always a little bit of a mystery to Microsoft-centric folks. As well as if you want to create a link server, you can create a link server from a SQL Server instance to, say, an Oracle instance, and then you can use four-part naming to run select queries against that Oracle instance. So having a link server is a way of really parking the information about, maybe it's another SQL Server, maybe it's another competitive database platform. You can link in that database into your SQL Server, run queries from your Management Studio, so you get all the familiarity of running a SQL query against a competitive vendor database in the context of SQL Server. So what this is here is just kind of a way of showing that same notion where you've got, on the top you've got an Oracle connection, in the bottom you've got a SQL Server connection, and on the Oracle side, here's the TNSNames.ORA file that I mentioned earlier. In SQL Server, you have this idea of a TDS endpoint, and so the way that you connect, say, from an application is a little bit different from say a graphical standpoint here, looking at the data. But really, on the SQL side, it's creating something like a connection string through ADO.NET, or say an OLEDB connection, or if you want to use ODBC, which is a little more archaic, but that's possible too. And then in Oracle, you have a configuration done through TNSNames.ORA. So any thoughts on this, Christine?
No, again, same kind of concept, being able to connect, just a little bit different in terms of the technology and the terminology we use.
Okay. All right, let's talk a little bit about administration here. And this is a SQL Server-centric slide, so we'll talk about the data dictionary. The data dictionary is really just the system catalog. And we talked about this earlier, but the system catalog allows you to look at the internals of your SQL Server system, whether it's, say, a given database. You can look at all the tables, all the user-defined functions, all the stored procedures, all the objects, all the users that exist in that database. You can query them through a T-SQL interface and through something called the information schema. So if you look at, say, the information schema.tables, then you'll be able to find all the tables that exist in that database. And again, it's a great way to dynamically create SQL statements on the fly if you want, or just interrogate, you know, what are the different tables, what are the different indexes in this database, and you know, how do I list those, interrogate those, sort those, filter those, etc. Any thoughts, Christine?
No, and I think that's a good definition for folks that are used to Oracle to understand how it works in SQL.
Okay.
So I'll talk a little bit about the differences in memory management between the two database systems. Oracle DBAs, you're used to the fact that the memory is managed at the server level, basically to distribute memory between the different databases, different instances. From an instance level, Oracle memory needs to be pre-allocated, basically what you set up in your SGA. Size and performance of memory is basically viewed using performance views or OEM for Oracle. SQL Server, you can take a look at performance through the dynamic management objects. There's also memory related counters in perfmon in the Windows specific, and then also SQL Profiler, and then there's also some statements that you can use. So just to give you an idea of some of the places you'll look, SQL Server Buffer Manager, Cache Manager, and Memory Manager are the places to look.
Yeah, that's a great point. And if you want to look at these different counters, you can surface those up through Windows Performance, and you can graphically chart these things out in graphs. You can send them to a log file. You can surface them up in Excel. You can also look at them in .NET.
So we'll kind of share this when we'll tag team this a little bit. One of the biggest differences with Oracle and SQL, you can basically configure on the Oracle side. You can do a little bit more configuration on the background processes, whereas in SQL Server, it's out of the box. They're already tuned to work with Windows, so there's a little bit fewer configuration options there. Oracle shared processes, you configure them using parameters when you set up the databases, things like Dispatcher, shared services and Mac shared servers, things, init.org parameters that you're used to setting. SQL Server worker threads, you basically control those using Mac worker threads as a configuration option, so that's a little bit different in the setup. From an Oracle perspective, the number of processes and also the performance of the processes, sometimes some of those parameters are dynamic and they can be updated in Enterprise Manager, or if you're used to doing things through init.org parameters, that's how you would set them up for when the database first comes up.
Yeah, so once you get past the hello world of databases, really it becomes a DBA mandate to figure out, how do I look inside the SQL Server? How do I find out what is going well, what's not going well? How do I set up a kind of a heads-up display on my SQL Server to figure out how am I doing on memory management, on disk I/O, on you know, memory usage, process usage, all these types of counters that you're going to look at from both an operating system and a database platform. So that's where you can leverage things like Performance Monitor, SQL Server Profiler. In 2008, we've got X events as well, that you can have a lightweight eventing model that spans from the SQL Server down into the operating system. So there's multiple ways to really look at performance of both your Windows platform as well as your SQL Server platform.
We touched on how to manage storage, but just some basic tasks that either a SQL DBA or an Oracle DBA needs to do for database files, things like expanding and shrinking the data or the transaction log file space, and then also adding and removing log files. We'll mention it again that SQL Server transaction logs, we basically combine the same functions of the Oracle redo log and the rollback segment. One of the differences is that Oracle allows multiple redo logs. They're of a fixed size depending on how you set that up, and then those are switched in a cyclical order. So once you do a checkpoint, you move on to the next one. For SQL Server, the logs are variable in size, also released after a checkpoint or when you do a log file backup. So similar way to switch, but variable in size. Management of the table spaces, we talked about it, creating, dropping, and renaming, or changing the status. SQL Server, because it uses fixed size, it extends that there's not quite as many tasks involved with administration, whereas Oracle, depending on the configuration, there might need to be a little bit more hand-holding on the DBA side for that.
Yeah, good point. And also from the SQL Server side, just to the first bullet, as a DBA, you really need to figure out how you're going to manage things like transaction log space, making sure that doesn't get out of control, or making sure the database doesn't have lots of empty space in it that's taking lots of unnecessary space on the drive. So that's kind of an ongoing maintenance task that you have to worry about as a SQL Server DBA. Also things like spreading out the database across multiple files if you want to do things like backups or have a more optimized database. So the next topic we'll look at is managing sessions and transactions, and this has both an Oracle and a SQL Server component to it. So this really talks to the difference between Oracle and SQL Server, and I'll talk to SQL Server. In SQL Server, you've got the ability to look at things like, if I've got a session, a certain user that's running a long transaction with a specific stored proc, I can look at different reports that tells me how my system's performing, and I can surface those reports up to say a lead DBA who can look at those, you know, what is the store product that's running most frequently, or you know, how are things performing from a T-SQL batches completed standpoint, things like that. So there's all sorts of methods to metric and monitor both your SQL Server and your Oracle DBMS, and really there's not a lot of differences here unless, Christine, you have anything there.
No, really very similar, just a different way of looking at the information.
Okay.
So we wanted to talk a little bit about how to get data out of the database, since once you have it all in there. Two different sets of tools. From an Oracle tools perspective, DBAs are used to things like using Data Pump for the export utility, certainly SQL Plus and the DBMS output, or a UTL file. You may also be using utilities like Oracle Warehouse Builder or Oracle Data Integrator. SQL Server, again, similar type tools, things like SQL Server Integration Services, BCP, SQL Command, PowerShell, Select or Print, and then Link Servers, which we talked a little bit about. But again, different tools to get the information out of the database.
And is there a cost for the on the Oracle side for those, Christine?
Yeah, some of them are. So things like Oracle Warehouse Builder and Oracle Data Integrator are add-ons.
Okay, great. Thanks. So this, yeah, just to Christine's point, SQL Server Integration Services was the next version of DTS. So Data Transformation Services was the predecessor to SQL Server Integration Services. It was rewritten from the ground up. It's multi-threaded. It's you can do integration with .NET. You can run any kind of maintenance task in Integration Services. You can do script tasks. Also, you can do things like in the advent of 2008, we added something called PowerShell that allows you to do things like manage your SQL Server, Exchange Server, Windows Server, all through a command line interface. There's also things like a select into statement or BCP that allows you to, say you've got a table and you want to create a new table on the fly, you can create this new table by calling a select into statement. And then as a subquery, you can say maybe combine, you know, queries from four, five, six different tables and push those all into a brand new table that is created through this this really creative select into statement. So, Christine, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is PowerShell. The benefits of PowerShell can't be understated. If I hate to show my age, but if you grew up with a command line, basically you can do things with SQL Server the same way you're used to working with Unix.
Okay, great. And this is just a graphical look at SQL Server Integration Services. You can do things like have four each loops. So SSIS is really, it's a graphical way of doing a lot of the stuff that you can do through the T-SQL language. But if you want to use a graphical user interface that's repeatable, that you can do things like easily send mail or create data flow tasks that have things like precedence constraints and you know, FTP tasks and all sorts of different ways of interoperating with the system and moving data in a both a performant and a consistent way that's got things like logging, looping, data flow, conditions, et cetera, then it's a great way to do that. You can build SSIS package and save that. It compiles much like a development project, and you can see if there's errors in your project and warnings and things like that. So you can also watch the data while it's in flight as well. And there's like data profiling tasks and things like that. So all in all, it's a great piece of software. It's integrated with SQL Server as well. And from a recovery model standpoint, there's different models that you can have, and I'll let Christine talk to any differences on the Oracle side. But you can set up your database to look at things like a simple model, which is very basic. You don't get much at all of the transactional features of SQL Server as far as logging goes, and then you move up to bulk logged or full. The more that you log, the more safety you have, and the better your backups are going to be, but also the more that you're going to pay a performance penalty. And in 2008, there's also options to do no logging that you can set up as well. So really you have to choose the recovery model that suits your kind of performance needs, your storage needs. And any thoughts on this, Christine?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is there's more granularity available with SQL Server than there is with Oracle. This is something you need to pay attention to and configure when you set up a SQL database.
Okay. Lots of built-in tools in SQL Server, Profiler, Performance Data Collector. There's a query editor. There's also a database tuning advisor that allows you to look at how good that you've laid out things like indexes and partitions. And it replaces the index tuning wizard from prior SQL Server releases. Performance monitor, things like looking at different counters. You can set almost an unlimited number of counters from both the Windows operating system as well as the SQL Server standpoint. And then you can look at Task Manager if you want to see how individual tasks and processes are running.
The database mirroring, something that's available with both database systems on the Oracle side, it's known as DataGuard. From a SQL perspective, it's probably our most popular high availability option. Basically, having a hot standby database to protect against a database or a server failure, you really get some fault tolerance there. Choices of either automatic or manual failover with both databases. One of the bigger differences is that SQL Server 2008 doesn't need a database restart if you do a manual failover. Automatic, if you do an automatic failover, we have in SQL Server the ability to do a transparent client redirect so the application can go use the new server the same way as it works in Oracle. Really no shared components, so this allows you to have a separate copy of the database on two different servers. One of the nice features with SQL Server 2008 is we've allowed the ability to compress the log file stream as it moves from the principal to the mirror, which really improves performance. And then the one other item that we didn't note on the slide is that the primary copy on SQL Server, if it detects a bad block, it can actually reach out to the mirrored server to grab a good copy of that page. That's not something that's available within the Oracle database.
Great. So both in Oracle and SQL Server, there's this notion of clustering. You can have active-active or active-passive clusters. And clustering is a little bit misunderstood by a lot of our customers in the sense that they believe it's going to help them with scale. But really what it helps is more for high availability. So you can have a Windows cluster that you add a SQL Server to. You can have up to 16 node clusters. And either it's active-active, meaning that you can have two SQL servers running separate copies of data on two different servers, for example, and if one of the servers goes down, then the other server will pick up the load of the first server. So there's all sorts of kind of talk about Oracle Rack as it relates to clustering, so I'll let Christine talk to that.
Yeah, so the biggest difference with the Oracle perspective, Oracle does sell the clustering solution as a little bit of a not just high availability but also a scalability solution. The one thing, you know, anybody on the phone that's had some experience with Rack, you may understand that you might need to change the way your application works a little bit to totally take advantage of that scalability feature.
And this is just a visual of how SQL Server clustering works. You've got, it's abstracted up by a virtual server up top, and then you've got a node A and node B that are underneath that abstraction, where you've got a cluster that's got a heartbeat between the two servers, and you've got a disk down here. It's actually, in the Microsoft world, it's a shared nothing disk, so this disk is actually split between node A's ownership and node B's ownership, and that's the difference between Oracle and SQL Server, a fairly significant one, where node A controls, say, half of this sand down here, node B controls the other half. If node A fails over to node B, then node B will control the assets that node A controlled, but there's not a sense of both nodes going after the same disk storage. So that's another major difference between SQL Server and Oracle. Any thoughts on that, Christine?
Yeah, absolutely. The shared disk versus shared nothing is a huge architecture difference between the two.
Okay.
So So a little bit about replication when we talk about the areas of data duplication technology. Replication is really the concept of being able to keep an object. Little different than cluster and standby databases. Replication, we're really looking at sharing and distribution of an individual object rather than the entire database. For both technologies, both Oracle and SQL Server, there's different types of replication depending on whether or not the copy of the data is read-only or updatable. The replica copy can be refreshed either in full or updated using discrete transactions, so really depending on what your requirements are. And you can do it synchronously, which is a multi-master environment, or asynchronously, which is all the other different types of replication that you can set up. Oracle streams, what you might be familiar with in terms of the technology and the nomenclature that Oracle uses, multi-master replication, which is a peer-to-peer updated replicas that go back and forth, materialized views, so another type of replication that customers don't always call replication, but having a master site with various policies, updating the replicas on multiple servers, and then also hybrid. So in Oracle, you can use a hybrid of replication and also materialized views.
Great. Yeah, replication is definitely a first-class technology from a SQL Server standpoint. And like Christine's saying, there's multiple types of replication. There's snapshot, which is basically just sending a read-only copy over as largely a backup or a snapshot of in time of that database. There's transactional replication, which is it's transactionally consistent data. So if you run, say, a trigger on an insert of a table, then that trigger will actually get fired on the other server when the similar insert happens there. And then merge replication is really, most of the time it has the same effects as transactional replication. It can be used, say, for traveling Salesforce where they're disconnected on and off to the network different times. And it takes more of a delta approach, so it might look at a transaction at 12 o'clock and all the transactions between 12 o'clock and, say, 12:03, for instance. But, say, a million transactions might happen to a single record, but it just looks at, say, for that given record, if it changed from Joe Smith to Joseph Smith, and, you know, tons of transactions happening at that record, it'll just take the before and after shot of that. So you'll get a lot less network traffic, but it's not going to be transactionally consistent. You're not going to get all the triggers and that kind of thing firing. So it really depends on what your needs are, but that's really the different types of replication in SQL Server.
So to talk about scalability with the different databases, basically a definition of scalability is the ability to increase resources to increase the linear increase in capacity. For memory, both Oracle and SQL Server allows dynamic resizing of memory without restarting. The process it can either be performed automatically, depending. Oracle added some technology in 9 and 10 releases of the database to allow some automatic resizing of memory to match up with what was already available with SQL Server and Windows. But you have a choice of doing it either automatically or manually in SQL Server, whereas in Oracle. Whereas in SQL Server, it's done automatically by the database. Oracle uses the process of parallel query slaves, similar technology in SQL Server, using things like that they call worker threads. So really to provide the same interoperation and interoperability in parallelism between both data manipulation and data definition commands. The optimizers that we talked about earlier are both aware of the parallelism, so they scale and take into account that that's available. Both Oracle and SQL Server scale really well when handling user connections using shared server processors, so those are the same for both kind of databases. And then both databases have a lot of different types and features for access to large volumes of data. They're both scalable. They both work well on huge workloads. And then SQL Server 2008 supports large-scale memory and then also hot adds of CPU and memory depending on your hardware environment. So That's something in terms of scalability and downtime that we offer with Windows and SQL Server to make some dynamic changes to the environment.
So to talk a little bit about Service Broker and advanced queuing, in SQL Server 2005, we introduced this notion of a service broker. And a service broker allows for messages, queues, and services to have these loosely coupled asynchronicity that allows for better scale and performance. So you might have a SQL Server that's sending messages to, say, from a regional to a branch bank office or multiple branches, and say that regional bank can't handle, the SQL Server can't handle all the transaction volume. It can use something like Service Broker to queue messages to the branches to take some of the workload there. So I know MySpace uses this feature significantly around things like queuing up messages to send to other SQL servers to have them handle workload during peak periods. So it's a great feature that it's more of on the development side that to be aware of for things like scale and for reliable messaging. And go ahead, Christine, if you want to talk to the Oracle side of that.
Yeah, so advanced queuing is something that customers use with Oracle probably before replication and then even things like mirroring and clustering technology. There's still some application to it, but again, with a very specific piece of advanced queuing within Oracle Streams.
Okay, great. So Sync Services is uniquely Microsoft. It's a sync framework that's built into SQL Server 2008 as well as into the .NET framework. And what you can do is have a sophisticated synchronization framework that say you, it's kind of like if you take your laptop on an airplane right now, then if the airplane doesn't have Wi-Fi, you can do a lot of things in Outlook, say write some emails, delete some emails. Once you plug back into that network, it's going to sync up and seamlessly do the changes that you made on your Outlook server. Well, it's very much like SQL Server. If you are working on a SQL Server database, you take your laptop home with you. You make some changes to your database. When you plug in the morning, based on the type of conflict resolution rules that you write in .NET, it's going to synchronize all your data back to the SQL Server database, make those changes seamlessly, and it's a way of keeping your data up to date as well as having the freedom to unplug from the network as need be. So something to look for in SQL Server 2008.
I can talk about the error logs a little bit. Oracle's alert file has equivalence in SQL Server. Basically, any log files in SQL Server can be read through SQL Management Studio or even a text editor if that's what you choose. SQL Server is set up so it keeps 6 SQL Server error log files, but you can configure it depending on your requirements or the amount of space you have available to save up to 99 of those error log files. By default in SQL Server, the trace files aren't created, but you can create them manually using Perfmom or Profiler. And then SQL Server, any useful information, things that normally would be in a log file, can be found in the Microsoft Windows application log file that you can read in the event viewer. So again, because SQL Server is so married to the Windows platform, we do share a lot of those log files, and you can find things in various places for the database.
Yeah, that's a great point. There's great great go-between SQL Server and the Windows operating system. So this talks about monitoring performance. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but things like memory management, process management, sessions and transactions, locks and latches, and then parsing, all these things can be looked at from a kind of a graphical user interface standpoint, from just being able to look at all these types of activities on your SQL Server or Oracle Server and to log those in a best practices way from a DBA standpoint. There's all sorts of tools that you can leverage for those things, like Activity Monitor, data collection, management data warehouse. Do you want to talk about these things at all, Christine?
Yeah, I think, and this is really the last point that we wanted to make today. Microsoft Windows and SQL Server tools. I talked a little bit about how they're inherently married together. Things like the data collector, database management objects, performance monitor, all those things can be used to monitor SQL Server. There's also third-party tools. So if you're in your Oracle environment, you're used to using things like Embarcadero or BMC Software or Quest or CA, those tools also have plugins for SQL Server as well as Oracle, so you might make the decision to use the same environment to manage both databases.
Yeah, and as we move forward to SQL Server 2008 R2, you'll be able to do even more management and oversight of your SQL servers and some of the features that you know that are coming out. So that's something to look for in SQL Server 2008 R2. If you have any questions about today's content, feel free to reach out to Christine or myself. And we hope you found this session today informative and helpful. Thanks.